Welcome to Season 1 of Disability Bandwidth,
a show where we talk with disability leaders each week about career, life, and technology. I'm Sam Prue.
And I'm Nikki Nolan.
Let's get started.
Would you mind introducing yourself?
I am Natalie Patrice Tucker. I serve as the Senior Accessibility Lead at Spotify. My pronouns are she and they. And I look like a Black woman with graying locks up in a messy ponytail with a pink sweater on and gray turtleneck. That's me.
It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Been looking forward to doing this interview because so many times people think about accessibility as like screen readers and screen magnification and that's it. And that's important. And we have those guests and we want to hear those voices. But I myself as a screen reader user sometimes think that we spend too much time talking about screen readers.
Well, great.
I would actually love to know a little bit more about you. What is your story around getting into your line of work?
Oh, absolutely. So I started way back in the early 2000s. I wanted to save the world. And I started off as a political organizer, but that was really hard. It was backbreaking, heartbreaking work, talking to strangers constantly. And I didn't think that was the way that I was going to save the world. But the tiny little nonprofit that I worked for had a database that wasn't being used very effectively because nobody really knew how to query it or get it to produce the kind of reports we needed. So I taught myself SQL. And from there, I was like, you know, this is what I can do. I can support nonprofits with technology stuff because that was something I was really great at. And so eventually I was setting up databases. I was doing administration. And eventually one of my clients asked me to build them a website. And I was like, hell, I can do that. And taught myself HTML, CSS, and JavaScript just enough to be dangerous. And I got really excited about standards and the possibility of an interoperable, you know, world wide web, semantic web. And just at that time, WCAG 1.0 was just getting off the ground, and I was obsessed with standards and the guidelines. And eventually, so I was building websites for folks who had constituencies in developing countries, older browsers, you know, slower internet connections. So we had to be really concerned about how folks were going to access the important information that we wanted to share with them. So at a time when folks were using Flash to get their point across, which made everything horrifying and all kinds of shims and whatnot to build a sort of a visual presentation for the web, I was really concerned about standards and semantics and those kinds of things. And eventually the federal government started hiring folks who had a background in building for WCAG 1.0 as they sought to enforce Section 508. And I went into the federal government and was like, okay, great, this is how I'm going to save the world. But the sort of strict hierarchy and slow pace within working in the federal government was not best suited for me. Mm-hmm. So I decided to reach out to someone I had respected for a long time. His name was Tom Babinski, and he ran an accessibility consultancy called Even Grounds at that time. Now he's off doing, you know, amazing, wonderful things at other places, but he was a blind business owner and accessibility consultant. And I reached out and I was like, I think you're fabulous. Can you teach me everything you know? And so I started working with him for a bit and learned a great deal, and then started my own consultancy and started working with folks. And then 2.0 jumped off, and it was like a whole sea change. Whereas the people I loved thought I was a front for terrorist activity because what do you do and how do you do it? It was just like, it made no sense. All of a sudden, I was able to do the work that I loved and have really interesting projects and work on, you know, really tough stuff. And the reason why I started doing it was because, you know, back in the days, early days, I thought, oh, if everybody knew about this, then surely if they knew and they understood, then surely we have this whole semantic thing, you know, web locked down like overnight. So I thought it was just a matter of education, which I think it still is today. But there's, you know, it's a lot more complex than that. So that's how I kind of got started.
I mean, that story is so interesting to me. And I think it's so common sort of for us, for those of us who got into the tech industry, right? In the late 90s and the early 2000s, mm-hmm. you picked up a book and you started learning some XHTML and you started building things for people. I I wonder, based on your experience in the industry, as we try and get more diverse folks into the industry, promote more diverse voices, is there still the opportunity for that like there was when we were coming up, where you just pick up a book and you start learning it and you build your own path? Right now it's all web frameworks and abstractions and and far more complex. Are we hurting diversity or like, I don't know. It's just something that I wonder about, because I don't think it's the story that the next generation is experiencing.
I think, you know, that's a brilliant question. And in some ways, I think it's a lot easier because there are so many formats to learn from. You can learn via video. You can do a self-taught class. You can do a boot camp. You can go to a formal program. You can get a mentor. You can, you know, make projects until you figure it out on your own. I mean, there's just so many ways to come at it. Whereas in the beginning, there were a lot of resources, but it was a lot to wade through. And not all of it was particularly accessible to lots of different kinds of learning styles. And also the barrier for entry, you know, in terms of just being able to afford a computer or afford assistive technology. Now you don't have to buy a $1,000 JAWS license to begin to understand how assistive tech works. And so I think there's actually more, but that kind of opportunity also presents some challenges, because it makes it seem like, oh, well, you know, because there are so many opportunities, surely, you know, marginalized folks are going to find their ways to them, which is not often the case. And, you know, there's still work to be done to make sure that we're thoughtfully making opportunities available for all kinds of folks and looking at the diversity of experience and what that makes available. But I think where there's a will, there's a way. And, you know, there are just more pathways now. So, yeah, I encourage it. I think it makes the internet more democratized, like tech more human.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe it's that there's more to learn today, but the barriers to learning it are slightly lower.
Yeah, exactly. So true.
So I'd love to roll into our next question, which is, you talked about this in the bio that you sent over for our Disabled in Tech event that you both were on the panel, which was great. And people should check that out if they haven't seen it. You talk about how you build an army of developers and stakeholders who carry out making sure digital accessibility is possible. How do you go about doing that?
Well, so I sort of alluded to this in the beginning, right? You know, accessibility is not for the weak of heart. It's real. If you're going to devote lots of your time to it, you're definitely going to have a thick skin. And I realized early on that there was way more internet than there was accessibility. And so in order to sort of expand that, if my goal was web that works for everyone, which is like this audacious goal, I decided to sort of pick to like, that caused me to have a career, right? But if I was going to make a web that works for everybody, I couldn't do it by myself. And the way to do that was to find folks who were naturally excited about it and support them, and also to like inspire other folks about what's possible when we can all contribute.
Absolutely. And you've sort of seemingly done this thing at, you know, in the government, in nonprofits, and now in Spotify, which I guess is still pretty startup. What are the kind of differences in these very, you know, different sectors when you're trying to build that engagement and that cultural education and interest?
I think that where I can really sort of introduce people to actual human beings and the impact of their sort of poor choices on actual human beings, it makes the most impact. And that's true whether it's a developer or a sort of, you know, less technical or someone more in leadership. And in the early days, I found that tough to sort of bring to life. How do we do that outside of sort of user research, which is very important and has its place, but not everyone can always be involved in it. And so I started building relationships with folks who I could introduce people to or direct folks to their work or sort of stay on top of what was happening in the communities I'm not, you know, directly a part of. I think that work has been absolutely fruitful, because mostly folks don't want to be wrong. They don't want to not know something, right? So the biggest difference from moving from nonprofits to, you know, the sort of tech industry, if you will, is that you've got sort of big brains with big degrees and and not wanting to be to do wrong, right? And there's this, there's an outsized impact on every single person because millions of people use this or that app or that sort of thing. So that can be a lot of pressure along with everything else there is to know to be good at your job. And so I like to sort of take that pressure off by being kind of a Cyrano de Bergerac in folks' ear, if you will, and just be like, you know what? This is the truth. You know, like if they send me a message on Slack, then they get the answer in 5 minutes and they can go off and, you know, like be the superstar and get things done. But it's like, I love supporting folks in the ways that they need, in the moment that they need to get things moving forward. It's all about velocity and connecting folks to the impact of their work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, often when we as accessibility folk try to do that because of either convenience or budget or time, there's this thing that happens where you look for the people with disabilities who already work in your company and you try and get them involved in disability, even when it's perhaps not their job. You know, oh, Joe in accounting uses a screen reader. We'll make him test it. And like, right. How do you, have you found that to be a thing that happens? And what's your kind of approach to when that starts happening and to solve for that, to work around that?
I think, you know, in the back of folks' mind, their biggest fear is that I'm going to bring up the fact that there are no people with physical disabilities. And I do often, you know, like I am that one. And so in some ways I want to make opportunities for folks, like you said, for Jim and accounting to be able to come in and do whatever wonderful contribution there is. But I also, once inside the organization, you have to guard and support folks so that they can really focus on what they're doing. And that's not the job, you know, like that's not explicitly someone else's job. And so we have to be creative. We have to be playful. We have to be thoughtful. And we have to build the kinds of relationships that make it possible for folks to want to come and talk to us about the products that they're using every day.
What we said there is so key, right? The diversity of the team to build a diverse product.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm so glad that those studies have come out, you know, recently that show that, so that you can point to them and be like, see, this is what I've been saying all along.
Yeah, exactly. We have the data to back up the truth that we have emotionally always known.
Yeah. I do think that it's really, really interesting that sometimes, so I'm the co-lead of our ERG for people with disabilities at my company. And I think people don't necessarily realize that just because you have a disability doesn't mean you're going to be an accessibility expert. And not
so real.
I feel like there's sometimes not the consideration that there are full companies that focus on, you know, accessibility. Mm-hmm. There are people who are trained in accessibility. Just because you have a disability doesn't mean that you could be necessarily even a guinea pig for a product. Like, it's about opting in, creating that space, allowing people to open up if they want to, but also not having that expectation on your employees that may have disabilities. I think that's super important for companies to know.
Absolutely.
As I've worked with Fable, it's been super important to know in my own personal journey, which, you know, just because I have a disability means I have lived experience and I am an expert in my own disability. But I think we also fall into this trap as people with disabilities where we now figure, well, we're an expert in disability, right? We can really speak to our lived experience, which, you know, I'm sure, Natalie, my lived experience is going to be very different from yours.
Yeah.
Sam and I have had these conversations. Sam and I have such different lived experiences having a visible and a non-visible disability. I'm going to go to another question that we have. What do you see as the downstream impacts of not including people with disabilities in the process of developing product ideas?
Well, I think it's myopic, really, just ultimately deeply myopic, stifles innovation. And of course, like limits the amount of people who are going to get to use your product at this stage in late capitalism. People using your product is a kind of an important part of the whole shebang. And so I think for the most part, folks are starting to dawn on them, mostly because of the hammer that is sort of legal approach to accessibility inclusion in some first world countries, but also just because folks with disabilities are being more vocal and being more included and in general, more a part of our sort of day-to-day conversations. And so you know, like the needs of the folks that we live with and work with every day are not sort of special needs or to just think about when somebody reminds you. It's, you know, it's your aunt, it's your uncle, it's your, you know, your governor of the state of Texas or whatever, you know, like it's people that we interface with, we can make real impacts on the way that they do their job or not.
I suspect you may have encountered a certain type of myopic thinking that I'd love to bring up and maybe talk a little bit about. And it's the myopic thinking that says that, well, we can't or shouldn't make our product accessible to people with certain types of disability because they won't use it, right? The example maybe is like, oh, well, we're a car buying website. We shouldn't be available to blind people. We don't have to worry about that. You would probably get, we're a music and audio website. We don't need to worry about being accessible to the deaf because they're not going to use our product, right? Is first of all, is that kind of thinking something that you've encountered? And if you have, how have you responded to it?
Well, I have been deeply blessed in that those are not the kinds of sentiments that I deal with at all, which is brilliant and delicious. Mm-hmm. Folks are just like hungry to know how we can move things forward and working to do that work, which is absolutely just a dream come true, to be honest with you, because I have encountered that before. And generally, it's easy enough to push back and say, you don't know who your customers are today, much less who they will be in the future. And it's just as likely that you will need these accommodations as your customers. So I pretty much, you know, easily dismiss it because what I do is make something possible, right? Make it possible for somebody to want to use your product.
Yeah. I love that. Like, we talked with Sherry earlier. And she's the best. And we sort of talked about how if you're not hearing from people with disabilities, it's not necessarily a sign that your product is accessible.
It's so true. People will set up all kinds of blocks and barriers to people like providing feedback and be like, oh, everything's fine. Like, actually, no, they can't get through the 14 hoops to like convince a feature team to add a label. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. So what's important there is that like at every stage you're thinking about how can we get more feedback? How can we set up a panel of folks who are always sending us tweets about our accessibility? Could we have a specific forum on our user forums for providing feedback and ranking the kinds of improvements to accessibility, all kinds of things, right? A user conference just for people who are concerned about accessibility and inclusion, that sort of thing. If you want to know, there are lots of ways to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. One thing that it makes me think of is, and this is like an ongoing discussion, I think, in the disability community and the accessibility community, is around privacy versus disability, right? Like if you're a big company now, it is possible for your app to detect if I have voiceover turned on, right? Or it is possible for you to guess based on the videos I watch or the podcasts I listen to or whatever, whether I'm a person with a disability. Mm-hmm. And it, like, people, I think, want to access that data with the best of intentions, right? Because like, oh, we want to see users with disability. We want to make our product better. But like, how do you feel about that? Especially, you know, as someone working at a company, like I'm sure you could potentially use big data to figure these things out. And is that a win? Where's the privacy line? What are your thoughts? Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a big debate. And I think it's a slippery slope, right? I want for my developers to, or for, you know, folks building products to think that at one point or another, everyone is going to be using assistive technology. Everyone is going to have a dexterity issue. Everyone is going to need, you know, one or another feature. And so it's interesting because at the same time, we want to also get telemetry and begin to access, get a sense of A/B testing, whether our improvements are working and those sorts of things. So I don't know that it's solved. We sort of take it on a piece by piece basis and sort of err on the side of data privacy.
Mm. It's a hard question, Sam. Oh my. Like, I was trying to answer
I
it
like
in my
the hard
head.
This yeah. is a fluff like, piece, you know?
Yes. No, it's yeah. just sort of like if you can read that someone's using a screen reader and then you pop up, hey, we've detected we're using a screen reader. Do you want to set up our product to make it more accessible to screen readers? It's like that reduces friction, but also that introduces data privacy. My mind is just sort of like,
right. I know it's a hard question. I was just thinking about it as I was prepping for this interview, and as I do, and it just suddenly occurred to me, you know, based on the three podcasts I've listened to today, somebody could look at that and go, oh, there's a blind guy, right?
Right. Chances are,
yeah.
But see, the thing is that's the slippery slope, is that we could do that around everything, right? You're a basketball player, you know, are a green person who only recycles, you know, like all of those sorts of things. And, you know, some of that is useful and some of that's not. And how do we determine what is and what's not, the signal from the noise, if you will, and do that ethically? That's really a deep consideration.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Didn't expect we'd come to answers on that one. I just wanted to put it out there because I think it's a fascinating discussion that is worth thinking about, and glad to hear that. And I think it's something that all accessibility practitioners are starting to think about right now.
Definitely.
Before we get to our next question, let's take a quick break to talk about our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Tin, the platform coordinator here at Fable. I'm a full-time voice navigation user, and before becoming the platform coordinator, I started out as a member of our community of accessibility testers. Now I help support the community of assistive technology users and Fable's customers as they work with us. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know just how important it is to integrate the voices of people with disabilities into every aspect of your accessibility journey. Fable can help you do that, from improving your team's accessibility training with Fable Upskill to working directly with assistive technology users with Fable Engage, we can help you take the next step on your accessibility journey. To learn more, check out our website at makeitfable.com.
And with that, we're back. Let's get on with the interview.
Let's transition into, what do you feel is your biggest success that you've had?
Ooh, that's hard. I mean, it's hard because right now I feel like, you know, like I'm doing exactly what I wanted to do for so long, which is building a team. And, you know, like I've often been the buck stopper, if you will, when it comes to accessibility around the things I'm doing, but really just to have a lot of say and a lot of institutional support. And, you know, like I'm not starting from scratch with Accessibility 101. We're actually doing work in hand. It's just, I'm really loving what I'm doing. And, and we're having wins and folks are using the product more and more, and that's delicious. And I think that would definitely be a win. What else? I got invited to join the WCAG, the WC3 working group around accessibility. And that had been sort of a bucket list thing to be able to contribute to this sort of standards making body that had been such a, you know, like, I have read every word of the standards, not just for accessibility and all of those myriad recommendations and those things, but like HTML and ECMAScript and all that. I love it. I love the whole process. And so that was pretty cool to be invited. I've also had the opportunity to support mentoring and mentor some folks in the space. And that feels really, really exciting. Yeah. So I feel like those are big successes.
Amazing. And seems like all successes that are building an incredible momentum that you seem to be building up.
I do what I love because I feel like I get paid to play. Like I get paid to do what I love. And the moment that it starts feeling like McDonald's, I'm going to stop. No offense to people who love their jobs at McDonald's. And so when I talk about, you know, like what I'm up to, I'm on a relentless quest for world domination in a web that works for everyone. That's really actually like how I get out of bed, what I'm doing as I'm brushing my teeth. Okay, world domination, where are we coming from? You know, like, and maybe it's a little bit of like a, you know, cartoon thing, but it makes me feel like what I'm doing makes a difference, even though, you know, like I said that piece about there's always more internet than there is accessibility, but it makes me feel like I'm carving.
And like, that's probably always going to be the way. And so we need to perhaps get ourselves to a space where the average person doesn't need to know about accessibility, right? It's like security. It's built in. And if they're going to do an insecure thing, they get a warning. Just, you know, if they're going to do an inaccessible thing, they get a warning and it's built in by default. Is that the ultimate goal of us as accessibility experts, is eventually to put ourselves out of a job?
Listen, that's my job. I thought, I had no idea. I had no idea it was possible to do this thing for 20 years. No idea. And then the things we get to do just become more intricate and interesting, mm-hmm. and the challenges become more exciting as technology changes. Do you know, mm-hmm. like, I'm always learning. I'm always, like, trying to figure things out, like making new connections and that sort of thing. So, yes, I do absolutely believe that we need to flip the script so that it's accessible by default, that things are mm-hmm. accessible by default, and it's a shocking crime when things are not useful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's just the way to go. And in the interim, we need the passion and interest and dedication of folks willing to move it forward. And so I think it's also important to sort of open the floodgates of who is and gets to be considered an accessibility professional.
Absolutely. And, you know, the new technologies are coming, VR and augmented reality,
yes.
and all this good stuff. Something I've been thinking about a lot over the last
Me too.
Couple of months. Haven't come to any answers, but hey,
and
perhaps
blockchain
that's a whole
and crypto and all of that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I before I started Fable, I did crypto for a number of years. Nice. So that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah. Perhaps, I'm gonna talk to you offline about all that.
Absolutely.
So let's transition to the flip side of this. What do you feel is your biggest frustration in your career? And is it still happening?
So, like, I feel like that's like a multi-tiered kind of like answer. And there's the actual parts of my job that are frustrating or not. And then there's sort of external circumstances. You know, I don't need to tell you that being a Black woman in tech has been interesting. I say with a deadpan and blink, blink. So it's hard not to hurt anyone's feelings, but it's not always been the best thing in the world. And so much less, you know, like adding on to that being autistic, you know, like it's just been fun every single day, let me tell you. But, and so those are the kind of structural things I deal with as a, you know, person in the world in general. And, you know, that's something that's probably not going to change in my lifetime, right?
I hope it does.
There's work to move forward. Every little piece counts, but, you know, I'm not expecting utopia before I kick it. But at the same time, I think in terms of my work, I don't know. I think there's just so many challenges, right? There's just so many challenges. Getting folks to have the information that they need, making it a priority, figuring against so many other priorities. Mm. That's always like sort of like a perennial, like sometimes I feel like my job is jockeying for position sometimes more than like actual accessibility work, you know. Yeah. Some days are better than others, but you know, like sometimes you just mm-hmm. have to sort of shove your way in there and be like, okay, no. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, and this is another sort of thing that I think a lot about. I think perhaps that one of the things we've done, and I wonder if you'll agree with this, one of the wins we've had is that we have moved accessibility from more of a personal problem, as in like people are not interested or don't want to do it, into a systemic problem where people mm-hmm. feel like the system and the project deadlines and the budgets and other systemic things are preventing them from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed that
in
your career, and has it changed the way you've had to approach accessibility?
Well, I think it's more in alignment with my own sort of way of thinking about my work and doing my work, because I think of access to information as a human right. And so I'm on a crusade, right? I'm thinking about people. I'm thinking about access. I'm thinking about contribution. And, you know, I started to sort of lose the wind in my sails if I have to convince you of how many people with disabilities there are in the world and why they're valuable at all. Do you know? It's like, mm-hmm. what? Can we just get past that? And I think that aligns with conversations we've been having around race and disability in society and listening to everyone's voice and ensuring that folks have a seat at the table has made it a lot easier to be like, no, we can't not think about people with disabilities. No, that's not what we're doing now. you know, just like you sound like someone behind the times if you are like, those people don't deserve access
to or don't matter or aren't important. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. The way we can move towards bringing people to the table and being more inclusive, I don't see the downsides to it. Like, I don't see the counter argument of making a more inclusive world. I'm confused.
Exactly. Yeah. That's where I come to it with too, is like, yeah, convince me that inclusion is not the way to go. Yeah. This is a revolution. Get on board and get rolled over. That's what I'm doing.
The thing that fascinates me though, and I wonder if either of you have seen this, is the way that these conversations in some ways have been more controversial in the disability groups. Like, I think if you talk to perhaps an ethnic minority, they would not say to you, oh, what, there's no such thing as racism. That's not a thing anymore. Whereas people with disabilities who will say, no, ableism isn't a thing.
Well, no, right? I think, you know, there are, you know, there's as many ways to be human as there are human beings. And I think because the conversation in society in some ways about race is more mature, you definitely, there's a lot more stigma to saying racism doesn't exist, right? Or just because I don't see it, it must not be affecting other people. But in the same way that, you know, ableism, and it can get really easy to be in a silo, right?
Yeah.
Right? Or to like have a little information bubble. And so I think the work there is, you know, is patience, which is not my forte, but also, you know, education.
Well, Natalie, maybe what you had to say about silos is very interesting, because I think too many times in the disabled community, we have people who will express themselves as, I am a blindness advocate, or I am an advocate for deaf people, or I am an advocate for people with autism, and I wonder if maybe it's because our community hasn't quite reach the maturity where we're saying, I am a disability advocate, in the same way that I think people of different ethnic backgrounds have reached the maturity to say, I am an advocate for racial equality, right? Rather than I am an advocate for people from this country.
I mean, I think there's a lot more of it than there had been. I'm really excited about it. Yeah. But I think that's just the natural trajectory of things, right? As we learn from what's working in other movements and in other intersections of our lives, we can apply it. And I mean, you know, disability rights and inclusion work has been going on hard and strong for quite some time. So it's not, you know, like, but there has been this huge, you know, sort of societal idea that's still tough to break through. Yeah. That people with disabilities need to be protected in some particular way, like sheltered and protected more than listened to and involved.
The infantilization of people with disabilities is so prevalent. I want to change topics. How do you feel people can be better allies?
Number one, listening. And if you don't have anybody to listen to, that might be a sign, right? So you need to open up who you're listening to, where you're getting your information from, who you're following on Twitter. Right? Mm-hmm. You know, just basic things. Being able to build human connections that you know, sort of forward the work. Because what you're, if you're trying to be an ally, ultimately you want to be an accomplice, someone that folks can count on to stand in the gap when privilege will make a difference.
I heard somebody say, start following people on social media who have disabilities and listen. Don't comment, don't do anything, just sit back and listen. That's important for people to do, is like seek out the people and just see how people are talking and see what's actually happening, and don't jump in. Like, if you're not disabled or if you're not in that movement, just listen. I think that's great advice.
I think I agree, but I wonder, I think for both of you, and this is perhaps an experience that is more unique to me, but so many people will go through their lives maybe interacting with a person with a disability once every 3 years.
Right.
And sometimes I feel this thing that, like, if people don't ask us the questions when they have the opportunity, they will never ask and they'll never learn.
Yeah.
And so I am always hesitant. And like, I get the feeling, right? Oh, sometimes you just want to go about your lives and you don't want to answer people's questions because like they should do their own research. But at the same time, if you don't, these questions may never get answered, right? And how do you balance that?
And I think that's the fundamental dichotomy. I think that in the community, there are folks who are like, yes, ask me anything and get, you know, like I will be your Sherpa onto the road of, you know, understanding your internal ableism or whatever the hell it is. And then there are folks like me who are like, if you don't come to me with a certain amount of information, I'm probably not going to entertain this conversation, you know, like.
Yeah.
Just like the limited patience and bandwidth for, you know, certain things. But like, and that's true everywhere. You know, there are some folks who are just like want to teach and folks who want to lead by example. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a place for all of it and for all of that to shift, you know, under certain circumstances. Like,
yeah,
there has to be a place for folks who want to be like there's such a great YouTube channel that's like, called like Ask a Blind Guy, and he like he'll talk about all kinds of things, and it's something. He's also got a very great like sense of humor, and you know, like he's very open, so he doesn't get offended by people being like, what, how do you live without purple, you know? It's like, you know, like, yeah. He just answers them, or you know, like gives a whole new perspective that's delicious. And I think there's a place for that, and it's a fundamental place, but we also have to invite folks to seek that information out for themselves and ask if they can ask questions. Don't go touching people or people's access devices or anything without their permission, just so you can get your questions answered.
It's a hard balancing act, right? Where are the safe spaces? Where are not the safe spaces? Mm-hmm. Something I struggle with. One of the things I do outside of Fable is I moderate r/blind on Reddit, which is kind of the official blind.
Oh, dude, so cool.
Yeah, blind thing for on Reddit. But like half of the posts there are sighted folks coming in with questions. And sometimes it has been expressed to us as moderators that this is drowning out people with disabilities, like ability to create a space for themselves to build community. And yet, if you reject these questions, they may never get it. I don't know. It's just something that I think about a lot, right? And so when this came up in conversation, I just thought, yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. Yeah.
It's so hard. It's like, I don't know the answers, but I feel like that's the biggest, hardest space for me in my personal day-to-day is this dichotomy and balance. So I want to just shift, and I'm going to jump into something actually fun. Maybe it's fun, maybe it's not. I don't know. We'll see. What is the first piece of technology you remember using, and what was it for?
Oh, I think we had some kind of Commodore, and I can't remember what number it was, but it had a tape deck as the hard drive. So this is like 86, I swear to God. It was like a long time ago. My mom was like a huge geek, and so we had all kinds of electronics. We were like on the internet the day after Al Gore invented it. I mean, basically, it was Star Trek in our house.
I hear you. Growing up with a father who worked at IBM for over 30 years.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And was also blind. So there was our computers, you know, talked since before I was born, which is a different experience. But yeah, I think that first piece of technology, right? It there's such a focus on like teaching kids to code in school. And I don't even know if that's it, right? It's just having kids grow up around technology that they can modify and they can work on and play with. It's like reading. If it's around you, you'll do it.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. And I agree that's true for everyone, right? Like that was the thing about the internet. It was like, oh my God, there are so many people. Like I thought I was the strangest person in America. When I was definitely the strangest person in my family. I was obviously the strangest person in my city. Like I was everywhere I looked, I was the strangest person. And then the internet happened, and this is dial up. We're talking AOL, you know, the whole shebang. I was on the internet on what do you call it? BBCs, I think they're called, these little bulletin boards, not even the real
BBS systems. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So like, yeah, IRC. Oh my gosh. So I was like going into these little chat rooms and meeting other, you know, black queers and, you know, like all kinds of random stuff I was interested in. I was like, oh my God, there are whole groups of people who who are interested in paleoanthropology. This is amazing. You know, like, I was like, it was like a whole new world was possible once I was able to sort of extend my boundaries. And that realization, I think everyone should have access to that. Like, anything is really possible.
It's the proof that you're not alone, right? People can tell you as much as they want, but you have to learn it.
Yeah.
I love that all three of us grew up with technology in our house, potentially before we were born. I also, my father has had computers and software, like, I believe, like, since the 70s, and I was born in the 80s. Wow. So I also came into the world with technology already being in my house and getting to play and, like, put things together. I feel like that's really important, the ability to play.
It is. I mean, there's also that danger in falling into the kind of grumpy nostalgia, right? I mean, IRC was better, right? Let's all just keep using IRC because it was all text-based and it was more accessible. And so let's never do any other chat app other than IRC, which is something that I'm proud to, right? But, like, it's super important to remember all of the wonderful advances that we are making, not only in accessibility, but in UI and UX and usability and lowering barriers and all that good stuff. But it's fun to talk about where we came from and reminisce.
So we've come to the end. People want to find you. How might they go about doing that?
I am easy to find on Twitter. My handle is Natalie Patrice T. And also you can find me under Natalie Patrice Tucker on LinkedIn. And that's the easiest ways.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Disability Bandwidth. If you like this episode of Disability Bandwidth, please subscribe and share it with friends and family. Today's episode was hosted by Sam Prue and Nikki Nolan. Edited by Nikki Nolan. Transcripts are written by Emma Klauber. The theme music is created by F.A. Achman. Special thanks to everyone at Fable, who, without their support, this show would not be possible. You can find out more about Disability Bandwidth on Twitter and Instagram at Disability Bandwidth, or on our website, disabilitybandwidth.com. Thanks for listening.